guess gonna have the news.
It's Monday. It's February 10th, 2020. LA Podcast is today's show.
LA Podcast is go.
Hayes Davenport, Alyssa Walker, Scott Frazier. We are in a different room, sonically, a different landscape.
Also a different headspace.
Different, mm-hmm. Yeah, different mindset.
Let's get in. We've got a lot to cover today. We are going to do our voter guide episode for all of the competitive races in the March 3rd, 2020 elections coming up. We're going to do that at the end of the show. But let's start with some LA stories and then some of the things that happened this week. So it's how everyone sign off on this format that I've just introduced.
Cosign.
Do you need to vote on it?
Yes.
It's the theme is voting of the show.
Let's start with an LA story. Who has one?
Mine's just kind of a bummer. I wanted to talk about yet another senseless pedestrian death in this city. I think we want to talk about this anyway, but
well, yeah, let's talk about it.
I think it's related to the conversation that we had last week about closing Hollywood Boulevard, for example, mm-hmm. to cars. As today's, when you're hearing the show, is Oscar Monday, and we'll finally be able to return to the streets of Hollywood, get it back from, you know, the celebs,
uh-huh.
roll back up the red carpet yeah. for us regular people.
Yeah, the red carpet is lava.
So a 91-year-old actor, I don't know if he'll have made it into the in memoriam reel at the Oscars.
Yeah, they're pretty quick with those.
So Orson Bean, who I recognized right away. Did you?
Oh, absolutely. I used to watch Match Game reruns on the Game Show Network like all through my childhood, basically. I totally know Orson Bean.
That's something we can talk about another time. But I think he was just one of those faces. You saw him, you recognized him. It was almost like you felt like you'd seen him around town. I don't mm-hmm. know. But he was tragically, this is so sad. He was crossing Venice, and you know how wide Venice is. It's mm-hmm. basically a freeway. It is technically. We've gotten it back from Caltrans actually in recent years. Right by Abbot Kinney, like right around the corner from Abbot Kinney, where yeah. there are tons of people walking all the time. Was going to see a show at a theater where his wife volunteered as like a usher, and was crossing the street as we all do, where there's no, you have to walk 3 or 4 blocks either way to get to a light, especially in this part of Venice. And there's a median in the middle. It's not that hard to like make one side of traffic and then keep going the other side. He was crossing at a place where a street did intersect it, but it wasn't a crossing, you know, a designated crossing. One car clipped him, and as people tried to tell another driver to stay away, that driver ended up hitting him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
as his wife is across the street.
Yeah.
Right. And then the reports, of course, are people saying things like a 91-year-old man is like darting out into traffic and, uh-huh. and the police making it that he came out between two cars, came out of nowhere. Like yeah. you shouldn't cross like
he's
here.
He's a wild hare or something.
Yeah.
And the implication was that the second car was distracted by all the people trying to stop it.
Yeah.
So, and that's why
and that precipitated him crashing into a person. Yeah. who had already been hit by a car.
It was, I mean, I think what the real problem we have to get to, we can talk about design of the streets, but our police reporting of that gets repeated by the media right away, which is almost local, always local news coverage. And even like the AP story about it was the police said right away, this is an accident.
Yeah.
We're considering this an accident, which I feel like is a newer thing they were starting to say about almost everything.
Yeah. Right? And also as if like, I mean, like unintentional is, I guess, a word that you can use.
Right.
But like, who's asking? Who thinks yeah. that like two different cars were targeting Orson Bean?
Right. It's just, and the fact that it just got repeated, and you know, I'm fighting with people in my timeline because I made, you know, just I made some comments that were just like, this is where I'm basically giving up at this point, because if we don't have the people who are supposed to one arrest people for hitting people with yeah. their vehicles, charges should be filed. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that you are going the speed limit on that street and not paying attention to, you know, people. There's people everywhere there. Yes. It's not like you're on a freeway.
Yeah, the idea that you couldn't see a 91-year-old man.
Like, he was tall. I mean.
Yeah, surrounded by other people trying to get you to not hit and kill him.
I just, this, I mean, and this guy, he seemed like he was so active. He rode his bike. He loved to get around town on foot. And this is how your life ends, this, like, wonderful life that you've had. I hope that the city maybe wakes up and starts to understand that this is a bigger conversation that needs to be had. Yet another European city revealed this week that they had a year with no pedestrian deaths. We talked about Oslo. Now Helsinki has also said they have had no pedestrian deaths for last year. It can be done. They had 60, 70 pedestrian deaths not even that long ago.
I mean, only if you but the calming waters of the Baltic can this possibly be achieved.
That has to be it.
Yeah.
And only crossing at crosswalks. Everyone in the entire city. It's amazing how they've done it. But I can say this. I hope it'll be a wake-up call. Maybe if the fame, if I was his family, I would just sue the city and try to get as much money out of them to put back into fixing Venice Boulevard.
I'm sure that's coming. I mean, this is the kind of thing, if you walk around L.A., I do everywhere. I have, if I were to like use near misses that I've had with cars hitting me as like LA stories, I would talk about nothing else on this show. You do have the sense that like anybody who spends any appreciable amount of time walking around in Los Angeles, probabilistically, sooner or later, a car is going to, I mean, in this case, it seems very obvious that the second driver was not distracted by the people trying to get him to slow down, but was already distracted, even in the police reports that indicated that he had to look up to see like where he was at on the road. Somebody's going to hit you if you're walking, if you're riding your bike, and the city's leaders do not seem to give a shit. It's very sad. And the eagerness with which the police are just like dismissing all of these incidents now is, like you said, Alyssa, it's kind of hard to have hope that this or anything else would be a wake up call for them.
I think Scott and I have the same story.
I have a different one, but look, you tell yours and then
we've talked about this a lot, but you and I were at Echo Park Lake twice this week. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Monday night and Wednesday morning, they had been warned of a sweep that was going to like clean them all out of the park, that people living at Echo Park Lake, at 10 p.m. So Scott and I and about 60 other people went to the lake to be there in case anything happened. Nothing did. There were some LAPD vehicles and a couple sanitation trucks that kind of like pulled up and left.
From the time that I arrived on Monday night or Wednesday morning? Monday night. From the time that I arrived, there was like a police helicopter. I think it seemed credible that there was something that was planned to happen.
Wednesday morning too.
Wednesday morning for sure.
So we went back on Wednesday morning when there was a cleanup scheduled, and that one happened, and I actually thought went pretty well.
It did.
It was led by sanitation and the park rangers. There were LAPD officers, a lot of them, around, but didn't do anything, sort of hung back. And they basically said, move all your stuff to the sidewalk, flatten the tents, and we will throw away any garbage that you direct us to, like stuff that you want to be thrown out, we will throw out. They threw out a lot of stuff. They threw out a lot of people's trash. The people leading the operation were very considerate, I thought, like spoke to the people living on the lake very respectfully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just in general, I thought it was like a big improvement. The yo-yoing of this is like so, like, it's like head spinning for everybody.
You do get the impression that at least, so when I showed up Wednesday morning, there were sanitation trucks. Sort of like it gives you like almost the impression of like military maneuvers, basically, right? Because like you're in the lake and there's the camp there. Everybody's waking up and starting to get their stuff moved. We actually, before the cops came and said that we didn't have to move everything out of the lake, actually we had moved several people's belongings entirely out of the park. But there are sanitation trucks parked on Santa Ynez and on Park and on Logan. Like they're literally just like peeking out from behind corners. There are multiple cop trucks like driving by, like Suburbans and stuff. And it's just totally it's imposing. And I think it's imposing by design. And you definitely get the sense that you are like surrounded.
Yeah.
And so I kind of felt like it was not the intention to be like the gentle face of the sweeps that morning. But that is what ended up happening. Maybe because of the presence of community members, maybe because of the presence of news media. But it did kind of seem like they were prepared to do what the homeless individuals at the camp said that they were preparing to do.
Right. Just the money involved, like you see so many officers. The helicopter alone is so expensive. It's all city money. It's the same money where like we could be allocating to services and housing.
Yeah.
Like it's you can see it just like being spent on other things, like on these sites primarily. Scott, but go ahead.
So just to finish talking about the lake, which they're gonna continue, at least they've indicated they're gonna continue having sweeps every Wednesday morning. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's in the area who would like to show support for that community and the struggle that they're going through right now, I would really recommend that you show up. Streetwatch is sending a lot of volunteers out there, and it is a very affirmative thing that you can do to show your support for people. I've had a lot of people ask me, what can I do to help? So give it a shot. It will be a good experience for you, I think.
The city is very sensitive about the term sweeps. Yeah. They are constantly saying that they don't do sweeps, which they do. They do them all the time. But I would say what happened on Wednesday morning, I am comfortable calling a cleanup.
Yeah.
And if that happens,
that's a step forward.
That is a step forward. And so, but a lot of it times it like does come with a threat of like, we're getting everyone out of this park and you cannot come back. That's what like people living on the lake are often told in secret by law enforcement, like before like the news and like community members show up, other community members.
So I wanted to, for my LA story, I wanted to just talk about this one single canvassing interaction that I had yesterday, which was so wonderful. My wife, Sarah, is a canvassing lead for Nithya Raman's campaign for Council District 4. We're going to talk about that more in more detail later today. So she's been going out in Sherman Oaks for a couple months now and just knocking on thousands of doors. Yesterday, I've done it once before with her, and then yesterday I went out and we actually got to go out as a team, which was really
very cute.
Which was it was very fun and cute.
That's like a date.
Yeah, it was like a 2000s indie folk sort of thing going on. Yeah, so we were out and we were just like knocking doors in Sherman Oaks. We had a great response from people. Just I think that for people who have never canvassed for a candidate before, I this is my first cycle doing that. Previously, I've only canvassed for like proposition campaigns or ballot measures, which is kind of difficult, because what you're trying to do if you're going out for a ballot measure is you're trying to explain policy to people at their front door. You're trying to convince them that they should care about something that they maybe have never heard of. For Prop 10, it was trying to explain the entire history of Costa-Hawkins in a way that was easily accessible.
And that in no means yes, and yes means
can you, can you just pause for a minute and just feel a little bit of empathy for the person who opened their door on Saturday morning to me? Like, can I please talk to you about this 1995 rent control legislation? I'm always amped up to talk about that stuff. Other people decidedly less so. But anyway, so when you are canvassing for a person, it's very different, I think. And I actually really enjoy it. And I think that it's the kind of thing that a lot of people could get into, because really what you're trying to do is represent, in this case, the candidate Nithya Raman's vision for what the city should be. And you can do that in a number of ways. You don't have to do that through talking about policy. You can do that just by having a positive interaction with somebody, which is really cool and feels very empowering. And so Sarah and I were out there getting very good responses from people. Generally speaking, it's just about making people care that there's an election happening.
Aware.
Most people might not even.
And to realize that this is a seat that has enormous power, and that they have enormous power in deciding who gets to have that seat. So it is awareness and fighting apathy.
People know that there's an election happening, but no, the one really consistent thing in all the canvassing I've done is nobody knows who their council member is really like what it is.
Right.
So We just had this one experience that was different than all the others, and to me was kind of like, it's not the reason to go out canvassing, because I think this is probably going to be a pretty rare interaction, but it was just like, it was so special. So we went and we knocked on this woman's door. She was an older woman. She lives with her husband and one of her daughters. We like walk up. Normally when I've been canvassing, I've noticed that a lot of times you get like a split of, sometimes there are older people who either have already made up their mind and don't want to talk to you about it. And sometimes there are people who just want to talk and have the company, both of which are okay. But in this case, we opened the door and we started talking about Nithya. And this was a woman who said, she started off by saying, well, is Nithya a Democrat? And I said, yes, she is. And she goes, oh, okay, I'm a big time Democrat. I vote the Democratic ticket. And then we asked her if she knew who her candidate was. And she was like, no, who her council member was. And she said, no. We started talking about David Rue. And she goes, oh, yeah, I've heard that name before. And she goes, well, don't worry, he's going to get my vote. And we were like, no, we don't want that. So she was like, oh, your person is running against him, but I just vote for the incumbent, you know, and because if he's a Democrat, then, you know, he's on our side. So we actually went into, she was happy to talk to us. We went into detail about what has happened while David Rue has been in office. And we talked to her about the homelessness crisis. And we talked to her about the everything that's going on the streets in her neighborhood. And she was just listening to us. And she was like, oh, you know, like, I've definitely seen things get worse. I've been in this neighborhood for decades. I've seen things get worse, but I also just like, I don't understand why with all the money that goes to it, like I don't understand what's not being connected here. And so we talked about the lack of political leadership, and that to her really, I think, made sense. And she was like, she was becoming really bought in. And then it so happened that she was like talking about how excited she was for the Oscars this weekend, because she is a SAG member. And so then I got to segue into Nithya running Time's Up Hollywood, mm-hmm. and like all the things that she's done for speaking up for people who don't have power. And she just goes, you guys are very good spokespeople for this candidate. I said, like, I don't worry. I think I'm going to vote for Nithya. And I was like, wow, we started from a place of, you're voting for the incumbent. You don't know who they are. You're just voting the ticket. And we ended with a vote for our candidate, which was, like I said, usually you're starting with no information, giving them some information, not I'm going to vote for the other person and now I'm going to vote for the person that you're actually canvassing for. But it was fantastic. It was a really wonderful.
Before or after Jane Fonda endorsed Nithya?
When did that happen?
That happened over the weekend. Okay. Busy Phillips as well as put out her.
There's like a Jane Fonda tweet that's like.
It was after, I think. Yeah.
Jane Fonda took a picture.
Reach back out to this homeowner and let them know.
Nithya did a sit-in at Fire Drill Fridays on Friday, and Jane Fonda took a picture of her through a window of her doing the sit-in and posted it on her social media. It was very cute. Okay, let's get away from electoral politics for a second before we get back into it, and let's talk about the expo line. What is going on with the expo line being able to move with just impunity through the city?
Alyssa, have you been following this since the report got posted?
I have only seen a lot of anger on Twitter related to it. It's hard to sift out all the anger. Yeah, geez. But there is some.
I need to stop being angry online.
Well, I think one thing is, we know what we were expecting, and it doesn't quite seem like this is going to be good enough.
Yeah.
Right?
So to recap, the Expo Line, the E-Line Expo is one of Metro's light rail lines that runs from downtown to Santa Monica. We have talked previously about how council member Mike Bonin, representing the 11th district, through which the Expo Line goes for part of its route. He actually authored a motion in City Council back in November ordering LADOT to look into ways that LADOT could speed up the Expo Line. It's been a major concern of transit advocates and transit riders for like the 6 or 7 years that the Expo Line has been open, that the light rail line has to stop at a lot of red lights.
The experience is frustrating in like the most primal way.
Yeah.
You're getting,
because you're on transit, yes, but you are also in traffic.
It sucks.
It's not what anybody signed up for.
Also really hard when you go through the part that has the dedicated bus lane on the side of you and the buses are flying by you and you are on a train.
Buses are killing it. Yeah. So Bonin's motion that he authored in city council was telling LADOT figure out a way to make the signal prioritization, which LADOT has insisted that they already do for the trains, figure out a way to make signal priority better. And signal priority is the thing that tells traffic lights when to be green and when to stay green because there is a train approaching. And they had like 60 days to do that. And they ended up exceeding that by about a month. But LADOT is back and they have their report about how they're going to speed up Expo Line trains. I mean, to me, this was an interesting and frustrating report to read. For starters, I feel like it specifically in order to trigger me, they started their background paragraph about the work that they were doing with the following sentence: LADOT is committed to prioritizing transit along city streets. This has never been true. This has never in the entire history of the LADOT been the case. They do not prioritize transit. You have to fight them. Like it's kind of like
sources.
Scott Pilgrim versus the world. You have to like fight your way up the ladder of the LADOT leadership to get anything done for transit. Yeah, this is a freewheeling cite your sources. LADOT provides transit priority. This is what they're saying already. Everywhere that trains operate in street running modes, and then they kind of blame train operators for any delay that they might be facing because they're not sticking to the schedule well enough, which is hard to do when you hit, for example, 20 or so red lights. But so in order to improve the experience of riding Expo, LADOT has been piloting a new kind of signal prioritization where they're going to extend the light cycle, the green cycle for one train, and then they'll shorten it for the next one. And they did this at the Expo and Exposition Boulevard and Normandy intersection for a while. They found that they were able to reduce the delay by 12 or 10, I think it was 10 seconds per or on average for trains going through there.
Intersection?
So that's the thing. We don't know because they only did this at one intersection.
Okay.
And so that was the average that the delay was reduced. And then they said that they went from three out of five trains making it through the light at Expo in Normandy without having to wait to 4 out of 5.
Okay.
So leaving a little bit to be desired.
That'll make it kind of fun. It's like
are you going to be on the good train?
Am I on the bad train?
Am I on the good train?
Am I on the bad train? So from the previous motion that Bonin authored, we know that there are 22 places that they are supposed to look at. LADOT is saying that they use this one intersection as a test, and now they want to expand it to all the other ones. So if we take the 27 seconds average delay, that's time waiting at a stoplight, the Expo and Normandy intersection, as a guide, if we say that that is average on those 22 intersections, that means that 10 minutes of your 50-minute Expo Line ride from Santa Monica to downtown LA is waiting at red lights. Yeah. 10 minutes. And if the reduction that they achieved at Expo in Normandy is also averageable across the 22 intersections where they're going to expand this to, that means that after this, it will go down to 6 minutes. So we'll get from 10 minutes to 6 minutes, which is kind of underwhelming, I think, personally. LADOT seems very excited about this.
Because they like to like add it up in terms of like those 4 minutes times however many hundreds of thousands of like passengers for this time period, like in terms of just like the human time that like opens up.
Yeah.
That is a lot, but in terms of like 4 minutes per person, it's not going to feel like that
not gonna
big
feel
of a
that
change.
Different. And it's like, yeah. So, and that's also the average. So it could still be worse. The thing is, most of these ungated intersections where trains are stopping at red lights are in the first phase, the easternmost part of the Expo Line between downtown LA and Culver City. So if you're going from Culver City to downtown LA, which is like a 30-minute ride, maybe it feels better that you only have that you are getting there 4 minutes faster.
Yeah.
For an end-to-end ride, it's not going to feel that different to people, I think. And LADOT is still not on board with doing full signal preemption where a train would get a green light no matter what when it is approaching, apparently. So that's your Department of Transportation people. They love to prioritize transit, don't they?
Let's talk about, there was a video going around this week. So we don't talk about it that much on this show, but like nightly news broadcasts in Los Angeles, for the most part, have been fully like circling the toilet bowl for the last like number of years. Any given night, you are almost guaranteed to see, certainly on NBC, where they do the Streets of Shame series.
Uh-huh.
Definitely on Fox 11.
Yeah, there's several different like series. Yeah, they're branded series where they're just like going out and saying, taking video of people and their belongings, mm-hmm. and they're right there in front of them and saying some of the most horrific things about, you know, the Streets of Shame in their branded.
Yeah, it's like the new content. Nightcrawler, which Scott and I talked about on this show. Yeah. You wouldn't go around to police like scenes anymore and like try to see like dead bodies and blood and stuff. You go to encampments, you try and catch someone smoking meth or like urinating on the street, and then that's what you put on television basically every single night. And so Fox 11 did this investigation about meth addiction, showing that it was widespread in Los Angeles, which is true, and tied it to, as many people who support the criminalization of homelessness do, Prop 47, which basically downgraded a lot of drug use and possession and other minor, like petty offenses, from misdemeanors to citations, things that you would no longer be arrested for, you would get cited. And they did this report that showed LAPD saying, we can't arrest people anymore for using drugs, and that has led to people using more drugs on the street. They get cited, they just keep using them. But the segment that really got around is Mayor Garcetti talking about this. So I thought we could just like play his words on this subject and talk about it.
LAPD expressed some frustration regarding Prop 47 with us. Your thoughts on how your police department is supposed to handle this addiction crisis?
I agree with them. If somebody gets arrested, they're not going to serve any time in jail. If they do serve time in jail, they're not going to get prosecuted. If they do get prosecuted, they're not going to be sentenced. And if they are sentenced, they're out right away.
So straight up, right away, saying it's a problem that people who use meth cannot be arrested, prosecuted, sentenced to prison. And if they are sentenced, they won't be sentenced for long enough.
Yeah.
This is actually kind of a shift in how Garcetti has talked about Prop 47. When it first came out, when the law first was put into place, which it was, by the way, because our jails were literally overflowing. We were at 200% of capacity in a lot of jails because how harshly we were criminalizing drug use.
Yep.
Garcetti said, first of all, the city got a lot of money to help process people who were like formerly in these jails and like get them into other forms of care. And he said, we've been handling this problem incorrectly so far. We have to find other ways to do it. This is a good thing. He was pro Prop 47 in the beginning.
He did not endorse Prop 47, and he will say that. But
once it was passed.
Yes. Yeah.
And now, instead of like, so it just shows like the sort of a lack of imagination around homelessness and poverty and all this stuff in general. For a long time, the people who are currently homeless on the streets of L.A. would have just been in like less visible in a lot of ways because they would have just been in and out of jail constantly, mostly in. Now that that's no longer an option because our jail facilities like could not contain them, the only solution that the LAPD, that our city leaders, our mayor can come up with for this population is to put them back into jail.
Yeah.
It did not work while we were putting them into jail. It did nothing to get people into better situations. They were just not visible.
Right.
They were just in jail.
And the state was violating their civil rights.
Yeah, absolutely.
According to the Supreme Court.
There's no evidence whatsoever that like arresting people made them like get on a better footing in their lives and like they decided to like stop using and like get better jobs or whatever. Like it actually makes it much harder once you're released to get a job, to get, you can't get the CalWORKs, you can't get benefits.
Right.
So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like you're like even more desperate than ever.
Yeah. You are being like fast tracked out of any possible means of getting back on your feet. Do we feel like, is it a coincidence that he is now a high-ranking official for like the only Democratic candidate who thinks that weed should still be criminalized?
Fascinating.
Is
it a coincidence?
Is it a coincidence, or is it just this is just who Garcetti is, and that's why they flock together?
I don't think it's a coincidence that he supported him based on that this is how he feels. Let's play a little more.
That's a broken system. I've been unafraid to say that. I know maybe sometimes because I'm a Democrat, people think that's the wrong talking point. I was somebody who didn't endorse Prop 47 because I had worries that it was the cart before the horse. I think all of us agree somebody shouldn't be on our dime away for two decades. But if there's no consequence at all, if people can't be diverted into treatment, you see the results on the streets of LA.
Diverted.
The phrase on our dime, too.
Yeah, it stands out.
Just making it primarily about the taxpayer cost to the non-imprisoned person that someone is sent to prison for two decades for drug use. It also like hand waves away the fact that like this process that he's describing of arresting more people and processing them and jailing them and everything is so expensive.
So much more expensive than housing.
Let's talk about what is the system that Garcetti is detailing here? He says Prop 47 resulted in a broken criminal justice system because we can't throw people in jail for whatever we want. It's not an issue of unconstitutional crowding. So clearly we should just be building more jails and keeping people locked up for an indeterminate length of time on our dime. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's just like what are the priorities that he's putting out here? They do seem extremely like a hard right turn for criminal justice.
Really, and right.
Yeah, right.
The people think that I'm a Democrat, but I'm actually a Republican. Like, I was so waiting for something else to come right there. But I guess if you're endorsing Joe Biden, you're almost there.
Yeah, I mean, and it coincides with the push from our new city council leadership and Nuri Martinez to criminalize more people, as if our memories are so short. Like, it was only not even a year ago that this was, I mean, like, and like pre-Prop 47, Prop 47 is so recent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't have a problem with the drug use in the, like, in Los Angeles. We didn't have a problem with homelessness. We had enormous problems.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the number of people who are homeless now is basically comparable to what it was before the financial crisis in, like, 2007, mm-hmm. when we had the ability to arrest everybody for, like, you know, for with it, like, just for whatever the cops wanted.
Yeah.
This will not work. Like arresting more people does not work.
Like, is that what he's actually saying? I mean, I think clearly with the deal being made with Ben Carson or whatever, you know, it's hard not to take it exactly at that, you know, at his word that we're cracking down, we're diverting, whatever. I mean, it's a menacing term all of a sudden, right, to hear this in context.
Cops
have been moaning about Prop 47 since it was put on the ballot, and they have been saying it's going to not make it harder for us to do our job, it's going to make it pointless for us to do our job, which is, and it's like, no other profession I feel like could you so loudly proclaim your absolute uselessness and like your unwillingness to do the thing that you think that you were hired to do and still be like venerated as some kind of societal savior.
It also this like us versus them thing, which we saw with the my constituents, you know, shouldn't be this idea that you're speaking about your constituents and not people who need help that are not your constituents. They are still your constituents, right? And this, like, our dime, it's not our dime or their dime or who. It's like creating this division when these are the same people that you put out a press release about saying that you wanted to help, like, last week. And so why create this division and try to make it like they're invading, you know, your city or something like that?
You hear a lot from sometimes in LAPD leadership and sometimes people talking about policing about how like they don't really want to be dealing with like petty street crime and like the crimes of poverty and things like that. They want to be like, quote, protecting Angelenos and like dealing with like violent crime and stuff where they can actually be of service.
But, and blaming pedestrians for getting hit by cars.
But you listen to something like this and you're like, yes, they do want to be arresting people for petty crimes. Like they're basically saying it. They're saying, like, you know, listen to them when they say, like, when we see someone using drugs, we want to arrest them and take them to jail and then send them to prison afterwards for like a decent sized sentence. That's a
huge problem.
They are saying that's what like motivates them to get out of bed in the morning, and they don't feel like they have that motivation anymore.
Yeah. And like, but it also is like, it makes sense because that's why they get so much funding. I mean, like if they can't,
yeah,
like, you know, like the more things that are eligible to be crimes, uh-huh, the more funding they receive. And we've talked about on the show how they're scored by the number of arrests that they make.
The logical extrapolation from what the police are saying and from what Garcetti has said in the two clips that you've played is they should get less funding, and mm-hmm, we should be redirecting that funding to the kind of diversionary services that Garcetti is saying that we don't have.
Mm-hmm. Are we ready? Are we ready to do this? To get into the voter guide?
We have a theme song queued up.
Let's see. I'll just let Brian, our producer, and you can leave this in, Brian, spend maybe 3 minutes putting together a theme song for our voter guide. And whatever plays now, that's what came out of those 3 minutes. And just like whatever you want to do, that's what it is. Because I agree we need a theme song, but I don't want him to spend a lot of time on it.
Decision 2020.
Great.
Yeah, just
great.
Remix Alyssa.
Just remix
it.
What Alyssa said, but just like only spend 3 minutes.
Throw in some scratches.
Yeah.
Decision 2020.
Let's start with the county. Is that fun? Is that a fun place to start?
Zooming out.
Yeah, let's go. So let's just say up top, like in terms of the state legislation, the state legislative races, the state Senate, state assembly, congressional races, there's not a single really competitive race, I would say. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
So we're only going to focus on the ones that are pretty competitive that are happening around Los Angeles. So let's start with the county. County Supervisor, District 2. This is one that we've talked about a little bit before. Running in this race are former LA City Council President Herb Wesson, who we've talked about a lot on the show, and State Senator Holly Mitchell, and also former council member Jan Perry is in the race. And activist, that is not necessarily the right word to use, but someone who has been involved in Koreatown neighborhood politics, Jake Jeong.
Yep.
Those are the four candidates. What does Supervisor District 2 cover? It's kind of a weird... Like cuts through like the middle of LA County in an interesting, like, yeah, the geographic center.
Yeah, basically it is. So it's South LA, a big part of Central LA, including Mid City, K-Town, as you mentioned,
Culver City,
going up to like the, yeah, part of like Westlake and part of downtown, and then down on the southern end, including parts of like Inglewood, and I think it goes down to Carson.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, basically big blob in the center of LA County, not including a lot of the more conservative South Bay areas, but including pretty much everything in South LA and a lot of Central LA as well.
And as far as like Wesson and Mitchell, like what areas of coverage overlap with their current or their form, you know, what their current jobs are?
Mm-hmm.
Like significantly in both,
yeah,
cases, right?
Koreatown, yeah, and Mid-City. Yes. Yeah, so this was something that we started talking about in the like middle of last year, that Herb Wesson and Mark Ridley Thomas, respectively, the current seat holders in Council District 10 for the city of LA and Supervisorial District 2, wanted to switch places, presumptively because they do overlap a lot geographically and because they share a reasonable base of support.
I think we're all in agreement on this one, that Holly Mitchell is the most progressive candidate in this race. She is, while she was in the state Senate, she was in the state assembly as well, but she was actually very active on a lot of criminal justice reform. A lot of the stuff that we're talking about now, downgrading sentencing, court fees, like she has been a real leader on that issue. I would say this race, in terms of how competitive it is kind of down to her and Herb Wesson, who has, yeah, raised a huge amount of money for this race.
Yeah.
Herb Wesson's, mostly, I think the primary indictment against him is that he led the city council during a period of just immense failure,
yeah,
across the board.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he is, like in terms of his politics, I think he is a generally... progressive in like his feeling,
yeah,
an individual, but the way he ran the city council obscured it from public view.
Mm. For sure. And I think it's actually interesting. One of the most interesting things I can think of about Herb Wesson is that during a time when we're seeing a lot of elected officials, a lot of LA highly public prominent figures start to take this more reactionary tone on a wide range of social issues. Garcetti, we just talked about. Nery Martinez, we talked about. Mike Feuer, we've talked about in the past, the current city attorney. We're seeing a lot of this like rightward drift to a more conservative law and order approach on a variety of issues. At that same time, Herb Wesson actually started becoming more vocally progressive on those issues, which was interesting. That being said, you know, I do think that I would rather see Holly Mitchell in this seat than Herb Wesson, specifically because I can't think about the LA City Council without thinking about, like you're saying, Hayes, this like era of complete failure that we've seen from them. And it was an era of unanimous consent to fail, basically. Like there was no dissenting voice. There's the leadership that you would hope would come from Council President Wesson was not used in an effective way to get the results that we needed. And we can see the results of that approach on our streets and in our city on a daily basis. So it's kind of like, progressive or not, even if he's taking a more renter friendly and friendly to the homeless approach to things, what do we expect that to result in on the Board of Supervisors when we know what it resulted in on City Council?
So let's move on to Supervisor District 5. This is the most geographically massive of all the five districts in LA County. It extends down to kind of the eastern part of the valley. It includes like Burbank and Glendale and like the San Gabriel Valley, and then extends all the way up to the like entire North County, the high desert up to what's on the northern border of LA.
Oh, what's the next county? Kern,
yes. Currently occupying the supervisor seat is Catherine Barger, who replaced Michael Antonovich, who was kind of a looming figure in LA politics, certainly one of the most powerful Republicans in LA politics. This is a Republican seat. Mm-hmm. It is pretty deep red, even though it does cover some places like Burbank and Glendale that are heavily Democratic. The other parts of the county are very Republican. Barger is a Republican. We've talked about her before on the show for taking a lot of helicopters to avoid traffic and spending a lot of money on that. There are a couple Democrats running against her who are relatively competitive. There's the mayor of Sierra Madre, John Harabedian, and Daryl Park, who used to work in the Office of Management and Budget. Daryl Park ran against Barger
last time,
got to the runoff in her first election. I was looking at that race. Mitchell Englander ran in it and got rinsed. He finished like fifth or sixth.
And said, "This is the end of my political career. Time to do some sports stuff."
So of the two Democrats that are running in this race, Daryl Park seems like a decent guy and has good policies. But I think John Harabedian he's the mayor of Sierra Madre, has a little more political experience. And just like looking on his website, I think his policies are basically where they should be in terms of allocating funding from criminalization to services in terms of homelessness. Providing health care for undocumented people is one of his policy like platforms. I don't think he's likely to win this
race. What do you think it would take for a Democrat to win? Because you said it does contain two major Democratic centers, Burbank and Glendale. Mm-hmm. Also, though, a big part of this district includes the area that Katie Hill won, running against Steve Knight. And, you know, like Palmdale, there are a lot of Democratic voters there.
Yeah.
So, like, what does it take to get this to not be a Republican seat anymore?
I mean, it actually, now that you mention it, it wouldn't surprise me, because I think most of the population is centered in the Democratic areas of the district, that maybe there might even be a Democrat registration advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I just think, you know, we talk about how no one knows who their city council member is or whatever.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
People in this room included.
Yeah. About, right? Like,
it's tough.
Like, county supervisor is so removed from our daily, like, not our daily experience. We do deal with the effects of their decisions all the time.
Yeah.
But they're just not in our field of vision for the most part. And so I think it would take someone who couldn't really rally attention towards this race. And Harabedian, I think, is a good guy, but hasn't broken through at all.
Yeah, no.
I mean, you know, and there's an opportunity because someone like Catherine Barger is not well known. Uh-huh. I'm sure, like even like in her, I think a lot more people would recognize Michael Antonovich's name, and I think that was helpful for her. But yeah, it would take someone who could
publicize the power of this office, which is huge. They each represent 2 million people.
I want to say before we move
big, too big.
But it is way too big. I want to say before we move on to the next race, because I think we'll talk more about the LA Times' selection process. But Catherine Barger was their endorsement last time around over Daryl Park, specifically because the LA Times editorial board was relying on this like ridiculous canard about being a Republican makes you fiscally conservative. Mm-hmm. And Catherine Barger should be on the county board of supervisors because we need somebody who's going to rein in these spendthrift Democrats, and it'll be good to have a voice of reason or an adult in the room or whatever. Meanwhile, she's taking a $9,000 an hour helicopter all over her fucking district. How so?
Which, like Alyssa said, it's too big.
How can you blame her? It's too big. It's not like there's a train that like runs through it or anything.
So that is your adult in the room on the county board of supervisors.
She's voice support for Trump's immigration policies. I mean, this is not like
get the fuck off the board of supervisors.
Yeah, this is the person who is kind of acting as the county's representative to collude with the Trump administration on our homelessness response. So I would say that's a huge red flag, red for Republican. Just remember,
they do a good job. She and Antonovich do a good job of seeming like sweet and nice by at the beginning of every supervisor meeting, literally holding puppies and kittens and like offering them, say like these are the animals that are available for adoption this week. It is very cute. Uh-huh. I enjoy it every supervisor meeting I watch or go to. But then you remember that they want to put people, children in cages,
in those cages.
As the that are being, they want to make space by getting all these puppies and kids out of the cages so they can put children inside. Let's go to the city council race. The even seats are up for election this time.
Oh, I didn't think about it like that.
Mm-hmm. So like some people are running unopposed, or just Marquise Harris Dawson in Council District 8 is running unopposed. A few other incumbents more or less are running unopposed. Paul Krikorian in Council District 2, Nuri Martinez in CD 6. I think both of those are just not super competitive.
Yep.
So we'll leave those behind. Let's start with Council District 4. This is a race between incumbent David Rue, who was elected in 2015, and Nithya Raman, who we've talked about a lot of this show. It's not going to surprise you that we are going to end up endorsing her, and Sarah Kate Levy. Those are the three candidates. To talk about like what we've alluded to Nithya's campaign in this race a few times, I think, and I've been like spending a huge amount of time volunteering for it, but I think that what is happening in this race and in this campaign is different than certainly since I have lived here, and I'm guessing in years previously, different than any other city council campaign that has been run. This weekend, as we're recording this, there are 100 plus volunteers going out and canvassing for Nithya. That happened in the prior two weekends. Like, there has been a huge amount of volunteer engagement with this race, and that is because of the way Nithya has gotten out there, brought attention to what is happening in the city, power of city council, the policies that have gotten, she's incredibly policy focused, like the policies that have gotten us to the desperate place where we are in the city, the policies around the 48% increase in pedestrian deaths in the last 5 years, the incredible increase in homelessness and how rents have skyrocketed and how much power and how bad our air quality has gotten, and how much power our city council has over every single one of these crises that they have either refused to use or have actively made worse in many cases.
I want to say something about that. I've been covering the presidential campaign, obviously, at Curbed, and having to write up a lot of these policy, you know, stories based on platforms and kind of dissecting what sets people apart. She has policy platforms that are more detailed than the presidential candidates on some of these topics, and statements and really like smart thinking on things that I've never heard a city council person talk about.
Right. Even though they have more individual power, I would say, to implement policy than any legislator nationally, then in many cases, the president who has to go through a legislative body. There are only 15 of them for a city of 4 million people. And they, in terms of their own district, they can sort of do whatever they want in a lot of cases.
Yeah. It made me realize how little I know about what a lot of these people are standing for in their own district.
The standard operating mode for being a city council member in the city of Los Los Angeles has been, they regard it as a joke and they have nothing but contempt and disdain for people who think that they should take it seriously. So Nithya represents a break from that tradition, which is desperately needed. I think to me, it's hard to really express how big of a victory it would be for Nithya Raman to win this seat. But to put it in one way, we couldn't find one sitting council member to vote against the extension of 8502. While these city council members were saying, we are trying to do everything we can to compassionately solve the homelessness crisis on our streets.
This is a lot for people who forget. Yeah, they were criminalizing people sleeping in their cars in the vast majority of the
city. Right. While they were doing that, they were at the same time extending a law that said, if you are sleeping in your car because you have nowhere else to go and your car is the only possession that you have, you are breaking a law. You might get your car taken from you. You might end up directly living on the streets. We couldn't find a single sitting council member to vote against that.
Mike Bonin said that he would have were he present for the last vote, but he did vote to extend it.
Yes. And that to me is a contrafactual that is just not compelling enough. He didn't vote against it. Nobody voted against it. It is since lapsed, but the fact that we have zero no votes on something that is so obviously cruel and so obviously inhumane and anti-progressive means that we don't have anybody on the council that we can rely on to push an agenda like this. So getting one person onto council who would make that stand, who would fight for that, is an enormous, it's an urgent need in the city.
Which is funny because the LA Times endorsements going to talk about
it? Yes, let's talk about it.
Because this, I think, kind of brings this full circle or ties it all together. I've never seen the LA Times do something like this before. Maybe they do, but I'm following. The races that we just talked about, and I don't think any more, just four, right?
Those four full-term incumbents.
Yeah, the four that we just talked about. They did as one story and just kind of did a little paragraph for each person. And they are saying, everything's great. Bring all these four incumbents back.
Well, it's worse. They began the article basically saying everything is horrible. We understand why, like the case shaking up
everything
City Hall.
Is actually horrible, but it's actually fine. Yes. Just give these
four
people
more years.
Give these people another chance. And I found, first of all, to not separate the stories and endorsements into their own links, even or if I'm going to drop my endorsement in like a Twitter feed or something, that's just such a bizarre strategy. Maybe they'll break them out separately or whatever, but I don't want my one endorsement next to someone else's endorsement like that. It's just a very strange, very, very strange thing editorially. That just really bothered me.
It was like they were kind of trying to sweep.
Yeah, they're
line.
Like, oh, like, this is so on. Boring. All right. Yeah. But really, too, with all the stuff that the LA Times covers, the issues that we talk about here every single week, to believe that for some reason, whatever percentage of the council, a third, whatever, should just come right back and keep on doing it. That just blew my mind. Mm-hmm. Like that, and we'll talk about the other council district that we've talked about many times. It was the one exception to that. But I couldn't even read it with a straight face because how can you say that we don't need a lot of change to happen in the council?
I want to talk about this specific seat for a second and like just some context on Nithya. She was born in India. She went to Harvard and MIT. She was a trained urban planner at MIT. Went back to India, fought for the rights of slum dwellers there, lived in a slum, fighting for them to get basic services like running water and electricity. Came to LA, wrote a report for the city administrative office at the City Hall on how the city was handling homelessness that found that 87% of the money we were spending on homelessness, which was about $100 million, was going towards the cost of criminalization, of arresting people and trying them and sending them to jail for an average of 3 days. Then left City Hall, had twins, started CELA, the group that I work with, the neighborhood homeless services nonprofit, that I have watched change how homelessness is handled in our neighborhoods. I have watched it get people into housing who would otherwise not have been contacted by the city or by the county, or would have at least had to have waited many years longer because of this neighborhood level process that has brought so many people in, has converted people from genuine, like generally empathetic to volunteers, to activists, to basically caseworkers for people who are homeless. And it has transformed outcomes in our area. This is a model that she wants to export across the city and I think is incredibly powerful. And then last year, like you were saying, Scott, she ran Times of Hollywood. David Rue, I think, is... So we talk about someone like Mitch O'Farrell, Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, who is more like openly disdainful in a lot of cases of people who are homeless and pedestrian activists and things like that. David Rue is much better at speaking the language of reform. He like refers to himself as a progressive, as a reformer, and like all this good stuff. And I think that in many cases, when the reforms that he has put in place are so ineffective in many ways, like to a deceptive degree, makes it seem like actual reform is happening when really nothing is at all. It makes it harder for real reform to take place, and it makes it easier for offenders to skate by.
Yep.
He's trotted out this developer ban, developers can't donate to city council campaigns as an example many times. This was a reform he put in place. Developers who have projects in front of the city can't donate to city council campaigns. So the way that has manifested in his own donations is at his last financial report, there's a developer in Sherman Oaks who has developed a ton, like hundreds of properties. There's like a ton of properties. He used to own the Mermaid's Bikini Club or something. And he did not donate to David Rue's campaign, but his wife, son, other son, employee, the employee's wife, another employee, that employee's wife, and his assistant all gave max donations.
A coincidence.
Yeah. Right? And why didn't he donate if everyone in his life is donating? Fake reform like this does nothing, and it empowers bad actors because it is so easy to get around. And then you can say like, oh, you actually did something. Dave Rue has done less on many of these issues than most other council members. In terms of approving supportive housing, he's 11th out of 15 council members. He has his district, after 5 years in office, has the fewest number of supportive housing units in the entire city.
Mm-hmm.
In terms, like, he's talked about like a few shelters that he's put up. Most of them are very small. The ones that are open, there isn't a single one for single bed for single adult males, which is by far the largest population of people who are homeless in the district.
Biggest need.
Voted in favor of 8502, was one of, I think, only a couple of council members to vote against the mobility plan, which expands bike and bus lanes across the city. Was the only council member to vote against Measure JJJ, which was an affordable housing incentive that the voters of LA passed by a pretty huge margin. I also want to talk about something that nobody does. Nobody at City Hall will bring up, which is the fact that he was accused of attempted rape of an unconscious person in 2002, was charged with it, arrested for it. The case could not proceed within the statutory limit, and so it was dismissed.
Yeah.
But the one article that has ever been written about it that I can find in the LA Times by Emily Albert Reyes contains a lot of details that I think it's fair to say. This case has not been, for someone who holds an extremely powerful elected office, has not been fully explored.
No, definitely not.
By the media, by voters, the vast majority of whom do not know about it. But basically what it says, what David Rue says is that, so he was discovered in the backseat of a car with a woman who said herself that she did not remember anything about what was happening, who was unconscious at the time of this encounter.
Right.
He was discovered by another woman the next day. The two women went to the hospital to get her checked out, and he was charged with and arrested for attempted rape of an unconscious person. His own lawyer in this article, and what he says is that the woman who discovered them jumped to an incorrect conclusion.
Okay.
But he doesn't say.
He doesn't expound on that.
Doesn't say this act was consensual, doesn't say anything, basically. So his office likes to say that he wasn't charged by the victim or wasn't accused by the victim. He was accused by a third party.
Okay.
That's because the victim says that she was unconscious
and doesn't know what happened
at the time. Yeah. I mean, she would have to corroborate it in some way for a DA to make. That's a big deal for a DA to make an arrest like that.
Yeah.
What his attorney says was that conflicting evidence emerged, and that conflicting evidence was that the medical exam of the alleged victim gave no reason to believe that she had been unconscious.
How do you test for that?
That's what it says in the LA Times article.
Oh, wow.
And we've just been existing with this information ever since it happened, which the next day, I guess.
No follow-up questions.
The medical exam, I guess, found you hadn't been drunk enough the night before to be unconscious.
They reconstruct your blood alcohol level in an hourly.
And whether or not that would have been enough to make you black out.
Whether or not you could have said yes or no. Wow.
That to me is shocking.
We have a public official on LA City Council who has been accused of rape and has never really been asked to account for it.
And his lawyer, and by the way, the implication of this is that she was lying, that the victim was lying about being unconscious. That is the implication of this. That is
disqualifying.
It is.
Without him coming forward and like giving a compelling explanation rather than just saying, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
With the understanding that we have of how sexual assault cases were tried and adjudicated by our justice system, all we have to go off of now is public opinion on these things. And you do, when you hold this office, have an obligation to account for your previous actions. You can't just leave it in the shadows like they want to do. And he has done
successfully done that.
Yes,
with
absolutely.
The aid, I would say, with the aid of the other 14 members of the city council,
absolutely,
and the mayor. And this is the when we talk about city council and this, like, the rule by unanimous consent and the society of friends that they have thing, that whole thing they have going on at City Hall, it's incredibly detrimental to the public life of this city, because none of these people are willing to say anything about any of the others. We have somebody here who is alleged to be a rapist and hasn't really provided any defense, but nor has he been called to account for those actions by any of his colleagues. There's nobody on the city council who thinks that this is a big enough deal to jeopardize whatever perks they perceive as being able to get out of their job just by going along and getting along. And It's not acceptable. It shouldn't be acceptable to voters in the city.
And it's created a culture of silence at City Hall that has led to not just only 2 out of 15 council members and 2 out of 18 city elected officials being women. 20% of sitting council members have been accused or charged with some level of sexual misconduct. Jose Huizar, of either harassment or inappropriate relationships, and John Lee, who Jose Huizar has termed out, John Lee is running again for CD12, was accused of sexual misconduct in a case that was settled out so that the city actually had to pay for his offenses.
Yeah.
And now we have, we'll talk about John Lee in a second, we have new council president Nury Martinez, a Democrat, endorsing him.
Yep.
And he is a Republican, I guess, very recently switched to no party preference.
Yeah, apparently all of a sudden he renounced his Republicanness, but I don't, it's, there's no like announcement, and there's endorsements for him coming in from Republican parties are still, you know, on social media and still posted places. So I guess you could still endorse somebody even if they leave the party,
I guess. And it's, I mean, this is just one small reason why basically everyone who currently occupies these positions should be voted out, with like maybe a couple of exceptions. But it's a very big reason to vote for Nithya Raman. Neither his sexual assault allegation or his policies individually are like the whole of the reason. They both on their own would be enough to vote for Nithya Raman in this case. And I also want to say Sarah Kate Levy, I think, is a good candidate, and I think she has great transportation policies. But I think for Nithya, it's her background in this work for her entire career and the movement that she's created that makes her the candidate that I support and have given my time to.
Yeah, I just want to say something about that too. It was great to see Bike the Vote do a double endorsement for this race, because they just thought both candidates did such a great job answering their questions about transportation. Like you said, safe, not just policy, but like safety and Vision Zero and making that a priority. So I think go read Bike the Vote. They have really great endorsements and ask a lot of good questions. And perfect segue to the last race, which we've talked about so many times on this show.
Yes.
So, and I think it for the 9th time, we continue to endorse Lorraine Lundquist.
Lorraine Lundquist. Back at it.
Back at it. She's been amazing. And talk about trying to flip a district from a no longer Republican. I don't know. but it could happen this time, mostly because of the great turnout we're going to see because of the presidential primary and all these other races.
For the first time, our elections are coinciding with the presidential election. It is an opportunity. It's the voting population is going to be bluer, younger, all the things that like tend to support Democratic candidates. It's a tough hill to climb now that she's running against basically an incumbent, although he's only been in office for a few months. John Lee, though, even with a short amount of time, has proven himself totally like unfit for this office. He's tried to kill a bike lane project, or at least to study, which is the first step to killing a bike lane project that his predecessor, who he worked for and was chief of staff for, Mitch Englander, supported.
Yep.
It was like gave his full throated support for. John Lee has tried to get rid of it. He's fought the only permanent supportive housing project that was proposed for his district unsuccessfully. It looks like it is going forward now.
Transit.
Bus Rapid Transit is fighting that as well.
I've been saying, and I will hold to this, I think that, so John Lee switched from Republican to no party preference. That to me is desperation. And that to me also suggests that he is very worried about holding on to this seat. Lorraine Lundquist, the CSUN professor who's running against John Lee for the second time in a row now, lost a very narrow election, a special election, a low,
technically won the first one. I just remember because she actually got more votes the first primary qualifying
which was on a date that actually coincided with some other elections.
Right.
Special election, very, very low turnout election. She narrowly lost that to John Lee. When we're talking about a higher turnout election and one that coincides with the Democratic primary, so the only hope that John Lee has is that people credibly believe that he is not a member of the Republican Party. That's the only hope he has to...
You'd be talking about it more. Maybe he is. I don't know. But
So it is a second layer of separation that he's trying to build, because this is a nonpartisan seat. The city council seats are nonpartisan, which is a way that Republicans always try and get away with, like suggesting that they are going to be independent actors. So by doing this, like 11th hour dropping his affiliation with the Republican Party, it is a way that he can hopefully avert the ire or attention of Democratic voters. I don't think that will work because people are not stupid, but also because just anyone turning out who has heard anything about John Lee, who knows anything about him, or who knows that the district that they live in has been Republican since forever, will be aware, and will definitely be aware because they'll be getting mailers every day and canvassers, that there is an option who is not a Republican. I don't think it's a lock for John Lee. I don't think that he has a good chance of winning. And I hope that that's correct. Lorraine Lundquist should be on council. And it is shameful that Nuri Martinez or any other sitting council member would endorse John Lee over her.
Mm-hmm. Some other council members have endorsed Lorraine. We should mention that, too.
Mike Bonin, although on her website right now, those endorsements are not listed. So, and if you remember
that
last
was for the
time,
last race. Yeah.
And in the last race, some of them waited until the day before the election to weigh
in on
this
race.
Might see
that again, or they might wait for a run. I don't know if we have another runoff of a runoff.
Yeah.
There's going to be another.
Oh, yeah. There will
be. And there will be runoffs probably. Likely. Yeah. In different races.
Very briefly, I do want to talk about the two open seats. Yeah. We've gone over our time, but Council District 10 that Herb Wesson is vacating, running for that seat are Mark Ridley Thomas, former supervisor of District 2 in LA County, Grace Yu, who is a Koreatown political activist, most known for opposing the shelter in Koreatown that we've talked about many times on this show, and Aura Vasquez, who's a former DWP commissioner in L.A. I like Aura Vasquez a lot. I think she is I think she's the best climate candidate. That's her background. And I think she has much better policies around homelessness and housing affordability. And she's correctly called out Mark Ridley Thomas for trying to take the case to criminalize more people who are homeless for sleeping on the street to Trump Supreme Court. Yep. That is a vote that he made and championed while advertising himself as a major homelessness advocate in Los Angeles, which at other times he has been. Measure H at LA County that like raised a lot of money for services. He was at the forefront of that.
Yep.
But trading every benefit that you provide for people in poverty with increased criminalization is not a strategy of like that will work or that is like benevolent to these communities.
We absolutely need to turn the page on this generation of public leadership in Los Angeles. I mean, Mark Ridley Thomas has been, you know, connected through his son to a couple of scandals at USC.
Yes.
I mean, there's...
Jeez, I forgot about those.
There's not a good reason. I would say it is actually the exact opposite of what the LA Times wrote in their endorsements. It's the exact opposite is true. There's not a good reason to think that whatever quote unquote on the job training that a politician might have in the context of the roiling atmosphere of Los Angeles in the just ended 2010s, that we need that experience, that we are somehow indebted to these people and should just like cling on to them for dear life. No, we need somebody new. We need somebody who is committed to attacking climate change and who is committed to ending the criminalization of homeless individuals. And Aura Vasquez is that person.
Because how that experience really manifests is just money. They raise way more money off of their connections to big business. David Rue, campaign finance reformer, has raised 1/4 of all the money for any city council race in this city.
Yep.
out of 23 candidates, a quarter of it is going just to David Rue. He's raised over $1 million. And finally, Council District 14 being vacated by Jose Huizar, who has seems like will manage to remain in office to the very end of his term, yep, despite an active FBI investigation. Congratulations to him. That is being running for that seat are Kevin De Leon, most famous for running against Dianne Feinstein in the last Senate election. Monica Garcia, former president of the LAUSD board. Mm-hmm. Cindy Audison, a nonprofit president. And Raquel Zamora, a public school teacher and counselor. Kevin De Leon is very well positioned to do very well in this race. I think he has led in the state legislation some progressive movements, both on climate change and on immigration policy. It goes back to what you were saying, Scott. I think experience in the state and in California government is as much of a negative as it is a positive in a lot of cases. We also, I don't really love that everyone says that he's using this as just a jumping off point to run for mayor as soon as Garcetti is out of office. So I'm happy to just let him. I mean, if he's going to be running for mayor while he's city council, while he's a new city council member, like that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm happy to just let him run for that seat from not having a job,
right,
rather than like you're occupying this important position and using it as a campaign springboard.
Sure.
So let you know, I'm happy to let him do that. Monica Garcia, in her time as LAUSD president, was generally perceived, and with good reason, as being kind of propped up by the charter school industry.
Yep.
That wasn't true across the board, so to speak. She voted in favor of the charter on the ban of new charter implementation near the end of her tenure, which got her a huge amount of pushback from people. And so, like, that was brave of her to do. But I think the balance of her career in that seat was heavily biased towards a single industry, which I don't think bodes well for her being a council member. Mm-hmm. Cindy Audison is the only candidate who supports bus rapid transit in Eagle Rock on Colorado Boulevard, mm-hmm, which is just good planning and good public policy. She's got good policy around homelessness and housing affordability and all the other stuff that's really important in the city right now. It would be great for this seat to be represented by a member of the Latino community that makes up the vast majority of the population. But Cindy, I think, is the best candidate.
Yeah.
And I think with the number of people running, there is a decent chance of it getting to a runoff. And I think she is the worthiest candidate to get to what will probably be a second place spot behind Kevin De Leon.
It's going to be a lot of women on city council.
It sure will.
Let's make it happen. Oh, do we want to finish by talking about DA?
DA. We've talked about Jackie Lacey a lot on this show. Basically, how I personally feel about it is George Gascon and Rachel Rossi, those are the two people running against Jackie Lacey. George Gascon was DA in San Francisco, left that position to run for this seat. Rachel Rossi is a public defender. This is a huge change in the types of people that run for these positions. Usually it's former prosecutors who are tough on crime. Very rarely is it someone who has advocated for accused criminals in the past. People talk about people who want Jackie Lacey out of office, which is a lot of people, including the LA County Democrats, which is like a huge deal that they aren't supporting her anymore. Worry that George Gascon is much better positioned to defeat her, has a lot more endorsements, has a lot more money, the whole thing. Is it dangerous to vote for Rachel Rossi? Are you then just splitting the vote? I don't necessarily see it that way. It's a top two election. And it maybe decreases the odds of Gascon just winning outright now. But I don't think any Rossi voter would then go vote for Jackie Lacey. I don't think you have to feel bad about voting your conscience in this race.
Yeah, no. I'm not.
I'm going to be voting for Rachel Rossi. I think it is meaningful to support a public defender for this office. I really like all of her positions. And I think, as with almost any prosecutor, George Gascon's record up in San Francisco is, while much better than what we've been dealing with down here, is a little bit cloudy.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of handling cases of excessive use of force among the SFPD.
Can I just say, George Gascon is running ads on DatPiff.
What?
Which is kind of funny to me. I don't know.
Explain to some of our listeners what DatPiff is.
It's a mixtape hosting site where you go and listen to just hip-hop mixtapes or whatever. I was listening to I was feeling nostalgic, so I pulled out an old Jeremih mixtape. And in between a couple songs, you get "Run, George, Run." George Gascon is coming out to LA to be the DA. And I was like, damn, this is so fucking funny. I just couldn't believe it. Anyway, yes, I agree with you. I think Rachel Rossi is the choice that I will be making as well.
But then if it ends up being George and Jackie in the runoff, George Gascon is the obvious
clear choice
candidate. Thank you so much for listening to our Log Voter Guide episode. We'll be back next week on LA Podcast. Goodbye.